Morning Show, 4 p.m. kickoff. And there's only one place you can catch all the action.
This is Queens Football on CFRC.
Need a place to go and watch a picture show? It's unique. Boutique, the screening room, Kingston's only downtown cinema. A cool and cozy gem. So silence that phone, leave your worries at home. Take an armchair vacation to sights unseen. Fly solo with friends or take a date. It's great.
We'll butter
the screening room. Independently owned and operated. Three screens with showtimes daily. Special events, private rentals, fully accessible. In the heart of downtown Kingston at 120 Princess Street. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter at screeningroomkingston.com.
Grad Chat is a collaboration between the SGS and CFRC, where we feature one graduate student or postdoc each week, providing them the platform to showcase their research and explain how it affects us. We also occasionally do interviews with postdocs, alumni, or grad students on topical subjects. Are you a grad student, postdoc, or alumni that would like to be interviewed? Visit queensu.ca/sgs/grad-chat to fill out the interviewee form. You can listen to Grad Chat every Tuesday at 4 to 4:30 p.m.
G'day, and welcome to the summer season of Grad Chat. The episode you're about to listen to is a repeat from our previously aired shows. We hope that you enjoy today's repeat episode of Grad Chat with CJ the DJ on CFRC 101.9 FM. Grad
Chat. G'day, and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you know you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, I would like to introduce you to Dakota Urban, who is doing a Master of Arts in Classics and Archaeology under the supervision of Drs. Jan Mathieu Carbon and Richard Askoff. Welcome to Grad Chat, Dakota.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know what? It's interesting. The very first classics student we interviewed here was back in the very first year in 2016, and she was the second person I interviewed.
That's awesome.
It is awesome. And she was doing a little bit of archaeology classics too, but And I remember then how fascinating it was and anything like, I mean, I love history and stuff anyway, yeah. So it's a natural fit for me, really.
Nice.
But, you know, that was 2016 and what are we now, 2023. So it's nice to have another classics person come onto the show. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, Dakota, you did your undergrad at Guelph in classics.
Yes.
Was it classics and archaeology, just classics?
Just classics.
Just classics. And what made you do that? Because classics, a lot of people think, oh, you know, some of people think just history. Some think, oh, that's the ancient world. Is it relevant for today? What made you want to get into the area of classics?
Yeah, so I actually started as an English major for the first couple of years, but I wasn't really intrigued by what I was studying. I then took a classics course just as an elective.
Right.
And I ended up having a professor that was...
inspirational.
Yeah, super inspirational, very enthusiastic in his lectures. And that was just, that passion was contagious. And so I ended up switching and just falling in love with the research.
So what is classics?
Classics is the study of ancient history. So it mainly focuses on Greece and Rome, but obviously there's other cultures that existed at that time period. So,
which I remember going through high school was pretty fascinating as well. In fact, I probably was better at that than other topics that I took. And so then you decided you wanted to continue doing classics as a master's. And unfortunately, we only have a master's program in classics and archaeology here at Queen's. Aww. But it's great that you're doing that. And so, as you said, you know, classics is more about the Roman and Greek times, which I guess then that sort of speaks to some of the things that you're wanting to do in your research. And I'll just let people know your research topic. First of all, master's is a short program. Any master's are short. It's 1 or 2 years. I mean, your research topic is transcultural language in diasporic Jewish inscriptions.
Yes.
Before you go into explaining what you're trying to do there, why this period of the Jewish and Greek and Hebrew Roman times?
Well, this is from the Hellenistic period to the imperial period. This is a time where the majority of Jews were living in the diaspora.
Right.
So they were living under Greco-Roman influence and authority. So it's a particularly interesting time to study that relationship between the two cultures.
Okay, so explain a bit more. What are you trying to do?
So yeah, I'm looking at diasporic Jewish communities as a cultural minority in the Greco-Roman world. And I'm exploring how the diasporic Jews adapted to different contexts mm-hmm. in their environment, while also cultivating their identity in this environment and making their identity accessible to non-Jews.
Right. So before you go on, just to make sure people understand, explain what diaspora means.
Diaspora is outside of Judea, where the Judeans come from. There were settlements across the Greco-Roman world. So this is the periphery of Judea, where the Jewish settlements were relocated.
So it's like it's not their necessarily the original, but they've set up other areas.
Yeah, they've either been exiled from their homeland or there's been voluntary migration to different parts of the Greco-Roman world.
Right. Okay.
No, so the way that I'm exploring this relationship between Jews and Greeks is through transcultural language on inscriptions. So I'm looking at how the language used in these inscriptions expresses the Jewish identity in a manner that fits both the boundaries of Judaism and also the larger societal structures of the Greco-Roman world.
Okay, well, that's going to be tricky. And I guess that's where, may I even say, the archaeology type stuff comes in if you look at that. Because if you're looking at inscriptions, are you finding, first of all, these inscriptions on paper, papyrus, or on stone? Or where are you finding these inscriptions?
These inscriptions are on stone. Luckily, there are databases that we can access the majority of these inscriptions. So that's where I get the information from.
And so you said you're looking at the transcultural side, the complexity of that. So if I'm understanding this correctly, the writings at that time from the Jewish settlements have a combination of Judaism and maybe Greek or Roman embedded to be able to make people understand the culture, both if you're Jewish or whether you're Roman or Greek. Or is it to fit in?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm looking at Jewish communities as a minority culture because that's mm-hmm. what they were.
Yes.
And so they had to accommodate themselves to fit the larger structures of the society so that they could participate in the society and be recognized in the society. So the predominant language of diasporic Jews was Greek. So the transcultural language...
So it wasn't Hebrew?
No, Hebrew died out until around the 4th century CE.
Oh, okay.
So these inscriptions are in Greek, and the language that I'm referring to as transcultural language is Greek language that is conceptually accessible to Jews and Greeks.
Okay. So that's a bit tricky, is it? Or not?
Well, it requires a certain level of peeling back the layers of the language and the different meanings. So I contextualize the language in a Jewish setting, in a pagan setting, which is Greek or Roman, and then I try and look at the language outside of that dichotomy. So how is this language appealing to both groups?
To both. Yeah. Well, that would be interesting because you'd see certain words that mean something to one and do they still mean the same in the other culture?
Yeah.
So trying to figure that out. So do you know Greek?
Yeah, well, my Greek is okay. It's these inscriptions are very small, so with enough patience, I can decipher the inscriptions. And luckily, the inscriptions that I'm looking at are quite formulaic. So you translate one, and then you have the answer for the other inscriptions with tiny little tweaks here and there.
Okay, so is the Greek language back then the same as what it is now?
No, there's differences.
There is differences now. So it's changed as the years of hundreds of years have gone by, so to speak. So with some of the things that you're looking at, how did diasporic Jewish communities in the Greco-Roman world, whereas we know at that stage, and as you mentioned, pagan religion was embedded in all sectors of life, how did they participate in the structures of the majority culture without compromising their own religious and cultural identity? Because we see that in Canada, right? We have immigrants coming over, and you want to keep your own cultural identity, but you also want to fit in.
Yeah, 100%. So there's this ongoing process that we see in relationships between Jews and Greeks and Romans, and that's the process of acculturation and enculturation. So acculturation is the integration into a society, but it's selective. You're not completely absorbed into the majority culture. You can adopt and adapt, but also refuse certain foreign elements to a certain extent. So, for example, Jews adopted the Greek language, but they didn't give up some of their traditional practices, such as circumcision.
Right.
There's then the aspect of enculturation, which is the active retention of one's own culture and the active engagement with that culture. So we find with the diasporic Jewish communities this ability to create a common ground where they were able to participate in the majority structures. So they were considered to a certain extent Greek, but they didn't cease to be authentically Jewish.
So their religion. So when you say authentically Jewish, it's the religion that stayed, or is more than just religion?
Well, so actually the term Jewish didn't exist in antiquity. It was Judeos, which is just means Judean. And there is the view in scholarship that we can't apply that religious connotation to that Greek term, that it's just an ethnic identifier for the Judeans. But there is a religion and culture and ethnicity are intertwined in the Jewish identity and in Judaism. So, yeah. There is a tie between religion and culture. They are ethnically identified from where they came, whether that's their ancestors came from Judea or they themselves came from Judea. But there is that self-consciousness in the Jewish identity that there is a longing to return to the promised homeland, because part of their religion is a promised return to their ancestral homeland.
Okay.
So we can't ignore that religious connotation that is a part of the Greek term Judeos, meaning Judean. The Jewish Hellenistic authors speak a lot about this longing to return and the religious elements that are intertwined in their cultural and ethnic identity.
So with some of the things that you're looking at in these inscriptions, does it show an internal conflict with themselves of how much do they take on the cultures of where they're currently living without without compromising their final belief is at some stage, I am going to be returning home?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There definitely is an internal conflict. How much do you take on and how much do you retain? We find that the Jews have this ability to accommodate themselves and their identity to fit these structures. And one of the models of looking at Jewish identity in antiquity is looking at the Jews as perpetually changing in their identity, whether that's religious or cultural. Now, that doesn't mean that they're fundamentally changing aspects of their tradition, but that they are able to adapt and that they are fluid and mobile in the boundaries that they have.
It's almost going back to some of the nomadic lives and things that people can be moving, and it doesn't matter actually where they're residing. It's more about, are we ourselves as an identity, as a group, keeping our identity?
Yeah, Yeah, for sure.
So you mentioned this word transcultural language. So what is, I mean, and a little bit about what transcultural language is, but in what circumstances is it used?
Yeah. Transcultural language is an idea that derives from the concept of cultural translation, which has three competing definitions in different fields of study.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Just what you need, right, when you've got a short master's degree.
Yeah. So in anthropology, cultural translation is the act of describing one culture to another culture,
right,
through textual documents. In cultural studies, it refers to the forms of negotiation that people engage in when they've been displaced from one culture to another.
Right.
And in translation studies, it is the act of not only translating one language into another language, but translating the cultural concepts of one language in a way that those concepts are accessible to the targeted language.
Right.
And so in each one of these circumstances, what we have is one culture making their understanding of the world and their values and traditions accessible to another culture. And this requires the creation of a common ground, or some scholars call it a third space.
Right.
And in this third space, there needs to be a language that is conceptually accessible to both cultures or the multiple
cultures. To all parties.
All parties, yeah, mm-hmm. For sure. So that's the idea of transcultural language. Is language that when these, in relation to my thesis, when Jewish and Greek communities are negotiating at the boundaries of their identity, it's language that is conceptually accessible to both of them. So there's a term, Theos Hypsistos, which means the Most High God. And it's found in both Jewish and Greek culture, also Christian culture. Because it is relatively anonymous, I mean, it doesn't name what God is most high. When we find it in dedications or invocations on inscriptions, and when there isn't an identifier on the inscription to tell us which culture is invoking the Most High God,
right,
it's difficult to determine who is invoking the God.
Who's speaking.
So this has led to debate in scholarship. Some people think, well, Theos Hypsistos is a single deity of a syncretic, unified, pagan-Jewish hybrid religion. I disagree with this, and so do other scholars, because we have evidence of distinctively Jewish usages of the term. So we have, in some of the inscriptions that I'm looking at, not an invocation to Theos Hypsistos, but to Theos Hypsistos eulogetois pantokrator, which is the Most High God, Blessed Almighty. Blessed in the Greek and in the modern term, in the English modern term, is distinctively Jewish. I mean, it occurs in throughout Jewish prayers. Baruch Atah Adonai, right? That blessed.
Oh, I know that one, yes.
Yeah, for sure.
I did that at summer camp.
Oh, yeah? So that's a distinctively Jewish epithet. And Pantokrator is used in sometimes in Greek culture, but mainly in Jewish and Christian culture. So what we have here is a distinctively Jewish usage of this transcultural term, Theos Hypsistos. On the other side of that, we have distinctively non-Jewish usages of Theos Hypsistos. And this is, we find in inscriptions on the stelae that they are inscribed on, there's either a description of the god's image, or there is a relief that depicts the god, or in one of the instances, we have a fragmented bronze foot on top of the altar. And this is an inconceivable notion in Jewish tradition. You can't, you don't worship the image of the god. So this can't be Jewish. This can't be a syncretic religion, because this is inconceivable in Jewish thought. And so what I argue is that Theos Hypsistos is a transcultural term that is conceptually accessible to both parties in a common religious ground. So Jews and Greeks knew that their god was the Most High, but also that there also existed another culture that believed their God was the Most High.
Right, right. Makes it tricky, though, for today, with you having to go and figure out, so which one are we talking about there? But I guess the point is, it doesn't matter which one. Whoever is speaking at the time will know which one they mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So is transcultural language an effective tool or mode of analysis for investigating how the diasporic Jewish communities articulated their religion in a pagan world?
Yes, I think it is an effective model because, first of all, it demonstrates the level of integration that Jewish communities participated in, and it also demonstrates a retention of their identity. So it further disproves a archaic or earlier scholarship that suggested that the Jewish adoption of foreign practices equated to syncretism or complete assimilation, which is the complete absorption into another culture or the fusion of religions. Looking at transcultural language allows us to see the fluidity of the Jewish identity and the duality of it in the processes of acculturation and enculturation.
So with this, with your findings and whatever your final results are, what are you hoping to do? Just prove the point that it's there? Are you hoping that someone, another scholar, can look at how you've analyzed the Jewish diaspora and use it in other groups? Because a lot of times we look at models.
Yeah.
You know, if it works for this, does it work for this? And are you hoping then that other groups can come in and say, well, you know, well, that was a good point, and you found your work on these stone inscriptions. Maybe there's other things like that that we can look at.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, some of the models that I am employing have already been established. So I am using, to a certain extent, some theoretical precursors. But yeah, I think this is, looking specifically at language, is a way to see how minority cultures interacted with the majority culture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it can be applied. I mean, we can use it in today's understanding how minority cultures interact with majority cultures.
Well, I just think about too, here in Canada with our indigenous languages that are getting revitalized because they're potentially lost. But how much was lost? Even with the revitalization, is it still picking up the stuff from before Europeans arrived, or is it from Europeans or the last 100 years? That kind of thing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting investigation.
Because I think we could do that with a lot of cultures.
Yeah, definitely.
Around the world that have moved around. I know even just any immigrant, I've moved around the world in all sorts of places, but there's certain things that I want to keep of me, but I know I've picked up a lot of terminology from around the world, and at times I get confused. Was that do I say project or project? And what was the initial? Because I forget. Is it garage or garage? Little words like that. And I know it's just language as opposed to a particular culture, but it's come from where I was born. I still remember that. Then in England, then going to Australia, which Australia is a bit British. It's trying to be a bit American. It's trying to be a bit of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Language is the way that you make your culture accessible to others. So for sure, it's an important aspect of that.
So what else do you want to do with this? Is it a fascination for you on how, I mean, you clearly love classics. Is it a fascination in classics of looking at the Jewish culture moving forward? Is it just because that was an easy one because of these inscriptions that you found and we know the Jewish community or the Judeans went to lots of different places, particularly around that time, for you to be able to look at? You know, is it you wanting to continue looking at how that movement happened, or is it you think about something else next time?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely intrigued by ancient Judaism and the interactions between Jews and the Greco-Roman society. I also think that this could be applied to other groups in antiquity. So that could be interesting. I do like the religious aspect of looking at Jews and Greeks. So that is, I'm not sure where it's leading to, but it'll be fascinating.
Can you separate the religious part to the cultural?
No, I don't think so. Religion
they are
was,
really intertwined, aren't they?
Yeah, they are in both societies, mm-hmm. Judaism and the pagan society, yes.
And what else are you hoping to find out from these inscriptions? Is there anything else that's popped out from these inscriptions that you weren't expecting to see?
There's so much room for interpretation in some of the mm-hmm. clauses that we find on these inscriptions, and there is still a great amount of debate in the scholarship.
Right.
So that's been a surprise is how we're still able to be having these conversations about the context of the inscriptions when they've been studied for years.
Right, right. Do we know who wrote these inscriptions in the first place? Because was it a religious person? Was it an everyday person in the street that wrote these inscriptions on stone? Who wrote them? Because that would tell us a lot too when we're looking at how to interpret them. Because as we know, even with Bibles or the Torah, it's written by, I don't know about the Torah, but I know the Bible, lots of different people. And which one do we choose? Is it this version or is it this version?
Yeah, so there would have been individuals who were trained to create the inscriptions. But in terms of identifying culture or religion, we have a list of criteria that we can use to determine whether or not the inscriptions are Jewish. In terms of the religiosity of the individual who the inscription belongs to or is describing, that's quite difficult.
It might not even be a religious person. It could be someone in the government that's writing this, but someone writing from a government's perspective could be very different to you and me writing.
Yeah. I mean, so the inscriptions that I look at, I'll give an example. I'm looking at manumission inscriptions. These are documents that describe the conditions of a slave's release. They're very formulaic. They are, for these particular ones that I'm looking at, are quite similar to other Greek manumission inscriptions that we see, but they're clearly Jewish based off of some of the terminology that's used in the inscription. So, for example, the witnesses of the transaction, the release of the slave, is the synagogue of Judeans. So that tells us that the Judeans are involved, that the Jewish community is involved. And the slave is actually released in some of these inscriptions at a prosuke, which is a prayer house used in a Jewish context.
Right.
So we can determine to a certain extent who's involved in the inscriptions.
But it doesn't really tell us of what's going on in that time because, again, it's one person's, even though it is structured and maybe like it is in other things, this is what's happening on today. This was the transaction, so to speak. It's a horrible word, transaction.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. So the fact it happened in a synagogue or something, could it easily have happened in the city hall?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, there is definitely a level of interpretation required mm-hmm. when we're studying these inscriptions. There's definitely potentially too much of an Eddic perspective when we study these inscriptions.
Right, yes.
So, yeah, they could have happened in different locations.
Yeah, it's always going to be tricky because unless you're actually there, you don't know for sure, do you?
No, 100%, yeah.
Because we know how truths and things can be changed.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a...
And I'm not saying that these are incorrect, but just from today's standards.
No, for sure. A level of interpretation is required. And mm-hmm. I mean, how much leeway you have in that interpretation. I mean, to a certain extent, because we're specifically in my research, I'm looking at language, so I can't change the meaning of words.
No.
But yeah, in terms of the broader context, there is interpretation.
Does that worry you, though, knowing, you know, I'm basing my work on this, for instance, one piece of information that I'm given. And is that an outlier piece of information or is it the norm? Or does that worry you? Because as an academic, so to speak, if you're putting something out, people expecting the truth, now you can only go by what you've got in front of you. But does that worry you?
No, because what I'm doing is I'm not just looking at the inscription itself. I'm looking at the inscription within a corpus of inscriptions. I'm looking at different inscriptions where, let's say, a specific term appears in this inscription. I look at the term in other inscriptions, in other literature. How is it used in different contexts? So I am contextualizing the information and comparing it with other places that it appears. So, yeah, there is a level of interpretation that I'm applying to my work, but also it is backed up. There are sources that suggest, yes, what I'm saying is
the truth. From what we know. yeah. from this, this, and this.
Yes, exactly.
You can only work with what you've got. Mm-hmm. And as long as you say, from what here is,
yeah,
the interpretation is this.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to it's carte blanche.
No, 100%. Yeah.
Not easy to do, is it?
No.
Well, Dakota, thank you very much for coming on the show. Like I said, I know it's only a master's program, but it seems like you've done an awful lot in that short time to be able to come up with a, well, eventually you'll be defending it and then hopefully people will get to hear a little bit more about this because, as you said, it is something that's not just restricted necessarily to the Jewish community. There are other diasporic communities out there as well, and we can sort of see how that's all working. So good luck with all of that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for the conversation.
Excellent.
Appreciate it.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray. Grad Chat.
Grad Chat. Hey, I'm Julian Taylor, and I'm excited that my radio show, The Jukebox, can now be heard on CFRC 101.9 FM out of Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. The show is all-inclusive. I only play music that I love and think that you'll love too. So tune in every Tuesday morning from 10 a.m. to noon right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Keep up with what's hot on CFRC Airwaves. Find us today on Instagram and Facebook. Follow us at CFRC Music and keep your finger on the pulse of Kingston's best music mix.
I'm Trevor from the Arrogant Worms, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Sego.
Buju. Anim.
Danacha. Ak anzeni shukwithan.
Tanse.
Ay, inu hadikai.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Welcome to Words and Culture. But I also have many nicknames. I'm also known as Mara, Maji, Mala, and I am Cham to my guest today. I'm your host in these episodes about Inuktitut, the language of us Inuit. There's something that we Inuit share that make us feel more connected, and it's nicknames. Do you have nicknames too? If you look at the map of the North, you'll see that there are no roads that connect us, so we still use the power of radio and television to share our information because the North has very poor internet connection. Chamanai or Lucy Kavavaukanai met in high school. You see, Lucy and I and others in the High Arctic also went to residential school. In our case, we were experiments to see how well we could survive in leaving our families in our small towns to attend high school in an Inuit community that provided grades 9 to 12. In high school, we had a very strict English teacher named Adele Corey. Cham and I were in Adele's communications class and volunteered our weekends hosting the local radio show in Mitimatalik, or in Pondinlet in English, where we were sent for school. Lucy Kavavauk and I called each other Cham because we had no one else but each other. Our families were so far away from us. Lucy is now the co-CEO of Inuit TV. That's a channel that is available to Inuit around the world, no matter where they are, for all material that's mostly in Inuktitut. Here's my conversation with my chum, one of my bestest friends, Lucy Kavavauk. Her family, too, was relocated by the federal government, even before my family was. I just want to start with the most recent news of you so that our audience gets a picture of where we come from as Inuit, specifically you and your family. Arctic Bay was a place where your parents were sent. Your parents are Unalingu Inuktitut speaking elders. But you've been fighting for something very special for them. Can we start there and talk about the relocation of your family?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Thank you for the introduction. So there's a former MLA. He's the oldest MLA in Nunavut to date, Isaac Suyuk. I'll just refer to him as Suyuk from this point. He's one of the last remaining direct descendants from a relocation that happened in 1935. It's actually first recorded in the federal government. So 1935, from Kinglake, formerly called Cape Dorset, there was my great-grandfather, my father's father, my grandfather, and it was his mother and her children that were moved from Kinglake to Tallaghatete, which is called Dundas Harbour in English. They were told that it was going to be a two-year thing where they were brought up through the Nascope boat, Hudson Bay telling them that they were the best fox trappers and that they wanted them up there for 2 years to get fox fur, and then they were going to send them back down to Kinglake in 2 years' time. So that's how it all initially started, and they had a very rough start. But 2 years later, Nascope came, as they suspected, to go back to Kinglake. Instead, they came with building supplies and dropped them off to Arctic Bay. In total, there were five relocations, from Tallaghatete to Fort Ross, to Fort Ross's, a couple of other places, and ultimately ended up in Taloyuaq. Suyuk really wanted an apology from the federal government. He felt left out, why other relocations have gone through and this one has not been recognized. My cousin Sarah Phillip and I started putting on the paperwork, taking care of the paperwork. We got a lawyer about 10 years ago, excellent lawyer, and he has dealt with relocations like this, the most recent one being Ahermut in Agvet area. He was already familiar with relocations. And so in December, we had our first Zoom meeting with the federal government after 12 years. We do have a society. We do have a board. Suyuk is one of our elder advisors. And we had our first face-to-face meeting with the federal government, Suyuk being the lead, Sarah, myself, our lawyer, and his assistant.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible, because for our listeners who may not know, my family was also relocated by the federal government in the 1950s from northern Quebec all the way to the high Arctic. So your relocation of your family happened before, but the legal process is just moving forward with the help of Elder Suyuk, who I remember as a member of legislature for Nunavut, and he was unilingual Inuktitut speaking. All his member statements were in Inuktitut. And this is how far we've come as Inuit, by the resiliency of people like Suyuk. You agree?
Completely, completely. There must have been about five or six federal government representatives and the people that I had mentioned. And right before the meeting started, Suyuk said, "Can I go change now?" And he came back with a red anorak, silapak, Inuit-made garment that we use. I suppose that's how we would say it. And he came back and it was red. And straight off the bat, he said, "I am here wearing this red as it's symbolizing our ancestors that have gone through huge amount of pain for what the federal government did to us. And this represents hardship. And I'm here carrying that. And I want you to see how this has affected our lives. But at the end of these meetings, at the end of these negotiations," and he pulled out a white one, and he said, "I'm hoping to wear this to represent everyone's gone through healing. This is something that has been purified, that we no longer carry that pain, and we're hoping to work together with you.
Yeah, our elders, and I think that we've been very fortunate to have been brought up by Unilingual Inuktitut speaking elders. As a mother, when I read and when people read of your experiences and former employment online, because everybody Googles everyone, and when they Google you, they'll find that you have three amazing children. And I just want to make that connection from the relocation to, and this happened years ago, to you helping fight for your father and his family, your grandparents. How important is this for you to allow your children see that this is part of our history, that they may not clearly know yet, but nor do our listeners. So the importance of having people understand what relocations have done to Inuit all across Inuit country.
Definitely. I hadn't realized, because we do things without really, in this case, like not really talking to anybody about this, just paperwork, and it just took a lot of years to get to this point. And when we were going for our meetings last month, I was talking to one of my children, and I was like, you know, the relocation file. And he was like, what are you talking about? You've never shared that with me. And I was like, oh, all these years they grew up, and I didn't share that information with him, and I was shocked. And I was telling them about it, and they were just completely in awe. It is because of the work. And I did tell them it is because of our elder. And he emphasizes that it really needs to be before he passes. He's in his 80s now. This is time sensitive, because we were hoping the elders that were alive would be there to actually see an apology. Because at the end of the day, this is what it's about.
That is so true. I remember whenever I came home at Christmas or summer from going to school with you, like we would leave home for, like, we'd get to go home at Christmas, and we'd get to go home in the summer for a couple months. And I remember my grandmother did not talk to me or tell us about their own relocation. And it wasn't until the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples came out with a report that did I learn about what happened to my family, what happened to my grandparents. And it's really heartbreaking. So if our listeners want to look up, there's some, how do you call them, injustices by our country that so many people don't know about, let alone our own families. Like there's still a lot of reading to do and storytelling to do, which makes it important, I guess, for you to use your capacity also as co-CEO of Inuit TV to be able to share those stories of the older people, of our elders from our communities, that show what huge changes they went through. And this is not 100 years ago, everyone. It's like we're recent. We're not even 50 yet, and we have this experience. I wanted to talk to you also about Inuit TV and your role in this. Is it's new, and it was huge news, and I wanted to ask how you are doing in that role.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy you brought up Inuit TV. It's one of my favorite things of all time to talk about. So about 17 years ago, there were Inuit that gathered together. There were educators, elders, youth, filmmakers, language keepers, and it became clear that we need to be hearing our language more. We need to be seeing our culture more. At the time, and it was all you, when you turn on the TV, it's all in English, nothing in our language. It was great when APTN came along. We were very, very excited. But APTN also has all of the Indigenous languages, cultures that they have to cover in Canada, and there's many. So the amount of Inuktitut or our culture that we were watching was clearly not enough. And so that's where that idea came in. There's been a few things that have been done in the background to get to this point, but the dedication of our board members, their expertise, current and over the years, have really brought us where we are. So NTI gave us seed money of 2.3 million for a 3 year for us to be able to start up. And that's where Tom and I came in. We were the first Inuit TV employees, both as co-CEOs. Tom McLeod, who is based out of Inuvik. So we came on, we started off running because we were told we were going to be launching our broadcasting in a matter of weeks, and we had nothing. We had no content. We, like I said, we took off running. So we just completely searched immediately everywhere for content. As you know, it says small industry, maybe in Canada, but particularly in Nunavut or in, on Inuit lands, there's only a handful of people that do specialize in this and that are very good at it. 2 years ago in February, in May, Tom and I ended up getting our first employee, amazing, amazing woman as well, Linda O'Shaughnessy, who is originally from Baker Lake, and she has like 30 years of experience in broadcasting, and she just completely relieved us when she came on board. So we launched in June.
Of last summer.
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And it's been absolutely amazing. We started off as a 5-hour broadcasting programming, and we do need to meet 80% of it in Inuktitut. We do try to cover the circumpolar world and all of Inuit and Nunavut in Canada. And we do broadcasts all across the country. We are on Shaw Direct, Bell Satellite, Arctic Cooperatives Limited, TELUS. We are all across. What's more amazing is that and we thank the people that do provide us amazing content that we get right now. We just recently, in the last few weeks, switched over from 5 hours to now until 9 in the morning till midnight, which is 15 hours.
Congratulations.
Yes, that was huge, huge, huge. Oh, it's just wonderful to be able to listen to your own language throughout the whole day, look at your own culture, and know that it's us that are doing it for Inuit. That has been a dream for such a long time, and we're telling our own stories, we're showing the world, hey, this is us, this is who we are. And it brings a lot of joy to be able to see this as an Inuk, for my children to be able to watch their own culture, because in Iqaluit, our children have grown up a little bit more different than we did as we lived in smaller communities. So it's been absolutely wonderful to be able to, I'm getting teary-eyed,
I understand.
This is how much, how important it is and how far Inuit have gone to be able to get to this point. As I mentioned, like it's perseverance, it's abilities, and for us to be able to, who you and I speak Inuit, but we don't hear our old traditional words that are not used so much anymore. So to be able to listen to those and to listen to other Inuit, how they speak all across Inuit Nunavut, has quite a feeling of unity. Mm-hmm. We are one. We may be separated by borders, but we're not. We're collectively Inuit with different experiences, shared experiences, just time differences as well. But it's wonderful to see that on Inuit TV.
Inuhatikai, we're going to take a little musical break before I carry on with my interview with my chum, Lucy Kavavauk. She is the co-CEO of Inuit TV. Here's an incredible Inuk artist originally from Saluit, Nunavik. She is Elisapi. Right now, she's rocking stages all over the world this summer. Her fifth album titled Inuktitut. In this one, she translates some of her favorite songs of her childhood into our language. I'm Madeline Alakarelek, and you are listening to Word and Culture. This is Elisapi singing Inu Neravit, or Born to be Alive. That was Elisapi, her Polaris Prize long-listed album titled Inuktitut. I love when she's explaining why she wanted to do this album. She wanted the elders, Inuit elders, to understand the lyrics of all of our favorite songs of our youth. There's still a lot of work to be done. Now we have lyrics in Inuktitut we want our youth to understand as well. My guest in today's episode is Lucy Kavavauk. She's the co-CEO of Inuit TV, and I call her my chum. I asked her if she feels it's too late to save our language, because though she and I are bilingual Inuktitut speakers, with Inuktitut being our first language, our children understand, but they don't speak it.
As long as we talk about our language and our culture, I don't think it's ever too late. You and I do have children that partially do understand Inuktitut, but that don't completely fluently speak. Mm-hmm. That's where we need a lot more support. We are losing 2% of it every year, which is scary. In just a matter of 5 years, it'll be 10% and so forth. I believe we just need a lot more support, a lot more people to be able to carry these on. So for Inuit TV, that's one of the biggest things, for us to be able to hear our language throughout the whole day, at least 80% of the year of it anyway, to be able to constantly hear that, normalize it. We do have children's language programs, and that's one of the biggest things that we're trying to focus on in terms of our programming, to cover all across Inuit Nunavut, or in the Canadian regions anyway. One big thing that we worked on last year as a team with our president and with a regulatory lawyer, we went down to Ottawa for a two-day hearing. The Canadian Radio, Television, Telecommunications Commission, CRTC, we're trying to get a five-year license, and we're hoping to hear sometime soon, and it would be a five-year one where we would be able to get a total of 13 employees for Inuit TV, and that is... and. From there, we're trying to move into a 18-hour programming, 18 hours a day in programming. And we're hoping to hear this summer or in the next few weeks what the decision will be.
The future of Inuktitut and the look of our Inuit culture, with the knowledge and stories you've heard from the visionaries, where do you see yourself in this, as we move forward into the next years, growing older? Inuit have so much hope. Inuit have such vision. Inuit have maintained, like, they tried to eradicate us. They moved us to foreign land where our hunters didn't even know where the animals were. But what did they do? They survived, because that's what we need to do. And I think that's an important message for the next generation. I'm wondering where you see us moving forward into the next generation of Inuit.
What a fully loaded question, Chelsea.
Yes, and my... Our English teacher, something like that, is not how you ask a question. That is not.
But that's how we do it.
Double barreled and everything.
For in terms of Inuit TV, like you said, there is a lot of hope. Yeah, Inuit are naturally completely talented, particularly in arts. And we see that in our seamstresses, we see that in our songs, we see that in our carvings, our storytellings. And one of the biggest things that Inuit have always naturally been natural at is storytelling. We were oral history, and now we are passing this on with new tools. So the younger generation, I can see the younger generation working for Inuit TV and just bringing in their own talent and their own ideas and their own visions, their our belief still being one, Inuktitut, and to be able to foster just building up and striving our culture. And I, with Inuit TV, I can see with the positions that we're trying to create, it's like, oh, I could see the younger generation making this even stronger. Mm-hmm. But with the foundation of our board, with the foundation of the idea, where it started, how it started, how many people that has taken to get to this point, there's just natural talent that I know with the youth that will be able to definitely keep this dream, keep this amazing, what came out of a little seed that just keeps flourishing, just to keep it alive, and our culture and our language.
Nakomik, thank you so much for sharing your